Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. I was talking to my mom one day when she said to me, "Have you heard of the Tyson Gang?" And I said, "No, I haven't. I don't even know who that is." And she said, "You really need to read up on it and do an episode on them." And I said, "Okay." On to the show. Gary Gene Tyson was born in Oklahoma during the Great Depression. He was one of seven children born to Reuben Curtis, who went by Curt, and Mary Tyson. Gary was the oldest of the Tyson children, and in 1940, the Tysons picked up their things and moved to California. They were trying to dig their way out of the financial woes that plagued many during this time. It wasn't Oklahoma that was the problem for the Tysons. The real problem lied in Curt's drinking and inability to stay out of prison. Gary's path already seemed to be laid out for him as he followed in his father's shoes. Although highly intelligent, Gary dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. He spent his teen years in and out of jail. Spending his formative years in a tough environment turned Gary into an aggressive man. In 1955, Gary was in prison in Arizona for armed robbery. His sister Martha went to visit him and happened to bring a girlfriend of hers named Dorothy. Dorothy was smitten with the charming Gary and she agreed to marry him when he was paroled in September of 1956. They were married on October 25, 1957. Their son Donnie was born in 1958. Their sons Ricky and Ray followed soon after. Gary Tyson tried to stay on the straight and narrow for his young family, but he couldn't hold down a job due to his contempt for authority. Because of this, Gary turned back to a life of crime. In March 1961, Gary went on a two-week armed robbery spree that ended with him being caught trying to steal guns from the local National Guard armory. While awaiting trial, he escaped from the Pinal County Jail. His taste of freedom would only last 48 hours after he was caught robbing a grocery store. On January 2, 1962, Gary was given a sentence of 25 to 30 years for his crime. During this time, Gary was diagnosed by a psychiatrist as having a psychopathic personality. The doctor deemed Gary very dangerous and highly likely to continue committing crimes. Despite the damning psychiatric evaluation, Gary had a trick up his sleeve: his wife Dorothy. Dorothy was a deeply religious woman who took her wedding vows very seriously. It became her life's work to keep her family together. While he was imprisoned, Dorothy brought her three sons with her every Sunday to visit Gary. It was her constant presence, as well as desperate letters to the parole board, that led to Gary's release on July 1, 1966. Gary's sons would often look back at the time of their lives as their happiest. Their father, who they believed was unfairly imprisoned for crimes he didn't commit, was finally able to be a part of their lives. Gary built up his image in his son's eyes, telling them fantastic stories about himself. This glimpse into their home life is what makes Gary's son's actions later so believable. Gary would only be out of prison for 10 months before he found himself in trouble again. On September 18, 1967, Gary was arrested for passing a bad check. He could have avoided charges if he paid back the store owner who was friendly with Gary, but he failed to do so and was back in prison by April. Gary was also involved in a smuggling scheme during his brief stint in freedom. He was smuggling farm equipment across the border. However, the deal went bad after Gary got greedy, and the whole scheme was exposed. On September 18, 1967, Gary was convicted on the smuggling scheme. While he was only sentenced to a few months in jail for the bad check, he was looking at an additional 20 years to be added to his previous armed robbery charge that he was on parole for. After his conviction, Dorothy tried to hug Gary before he was taken away, but she was pushed aside by prison guard Jim Steiner. During the brief drive back to the jail, Gary pulled out a pistol, which was probably smuggled to him by Dorothy. and ordered Jim to pull over the vehicle. Once they stopped, Geary ordered Jim out of the truck. He then shot him 3 times. After killing the prison guard, Geary hopped off the back of the truck and took off. Once again, his taste of freedom was short-lived after he was spotted by a citizen the next morning. Geary had a brief shootout with the cops but gave himself up after an officer shot the hat off his head. Geary was tried and convicted for the murder of Jim Steiner and was sentenced to 2 life sentences. Geary would never let something like a couple of life sentences keep him from what he wanted. He would immediately begin to look for ways to escape. He could always count on Dorothy and the boys for help, but he also needed help on the inside. Enter Randy Greenewalt. Randy was a serial killer with a genius IQ and a hatred for truck drivers. He was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for the murder of a truck driver in Winslow, Arizona, but it's widely believed that he killed many more. Geary and Randy would become friends in the Arizona State Prison. They would also become friendly with Harold Caldwell, the warden of the prison. Geary and Randy won favor with Harold when they refused to participate in a prison strike against the warden in 1973. Because of this, Harold moved the two murderers into the medium security wing of the prison, also called the trustee unit. It was in this new part of the prison, which was not outfitted with proper security measures, that Geary would see his chance for escape. Planning for an escape began in 1977. Geary would employ the help of his friend Randy, but also needed someone who could fly a plane. Part of Geary's plan was to acquire a plane and fly it into Mexico after his escape. It was with this in mind that Geary enrolled the help of Bobby Tucson, the only licensed pilot incarcerated in the state of Arizona. Well, enrolled is a misleading word. Bobby would claim that Geary made it clear to him that if he didn't help, then Geary would kill Bobby's wife and children. It wasn't enough for Geary to have a pilot on his side. He also wanted to know how to fly the plane. So while they had free time working in the prison's cafeteria, Bobby would show Geary how to fly with a makeshift cockpit that they crafted out of cardboard. Guilt would overcome Bobby. He would later claim that his intention was to crash the plane in order to kill Geary and Randy so they couldn't hurt anyone after their escape. Bobby told his wife Irma about the escape plan. Irma was so worried for her husband that she made an anonymous phone call to Harold to inform him of Geary's intentions. It didn't take long for Harold to figure out who the phone call came from, and he confronted Bobby. He called him a liar and a troublemaker. When Bobby requested to be sent back to the maximum security wing of the prison, Harold denied it. Seeing no other option, Bobby stole a pair of wire cutters and cut a hole in the outside fence of the prison. He then waited just outside of the fence for guards to capture him. After his escape attempt, Bobby was sent back to maximum security and had successfully ridded himself of Geary Tyson. Geary didn't let this setback stop him from his plan. He would find some other way to fly out of the U.S. The only thing that mattered to him was escape. In fact, he was willing to put his wife and 3 sons, all young men at this time, in mortal danger in order to get what he wanted. Geary Tyson wanted his freedom, and his past clearly demonstrated that he wasn't afraid to take it. Despite the previous attempt being thwarted by Bobby Tucson, Geary and Randy still wanted to make another attempt to escape. On Monday, July 31st, 1978, Geary's 3 sons, Ricky, Ray, and Donnie, arrived to visit their father. Ray arrived ahead of his 2 brothers and brought with him a picnic basket. This was not an irregular sight at the trustee unit, where the rules were incredibly lax for the prisoners the wardens deemed trustworthy. When Geary greeted Ray, he was put off by his presence. Guards overheard him tell Ray, "You're not supposed to be here." Still, the pair made their way outside to feast on the homemade ham sandwiches and Coca-Colas that were in his picnic basket. As the pair sat on the grassy knoll, no one knows for sure what was discussed, but they were probably discussing how the events that would happen next would unfold. After eating their lunch, Ray and Gary walked back into the visitor's room. His other sons, Ricky and Donnie, arrived in the visitor's room a short time later. Ricky was carrying a small and elongated box that should have held several packs of Salem cigarettes. Instead, it held a sawed-off shotgun. Donnie pulled a few pistols out of the ice chest he was carrying. He handed one to his father and one to Randy. Ricky had pointed the shotgun towards the guards in the control room. Randy had been assigned a job in the guard booth, something that would later be called into question during an investigation of the escape, and he quickly ordered the two guards on the floor. He cut the telephone and alarm wires to prevent them from contacting the guard tower. Gary knew there was a guard standing outside of the visitor's room. He walked out casually and pushed the pistol into the guard's stomach. He ordered the guard to not move or to try and call for assistance if he wanted to live. The guard obeyed his orders and walked inside of the visitor's room. By now, all three men had corralled visitors, inmates, and guards into two separate supply closets. The men locked the doors and barricaded the closets to prevent a quick escape. They packed up their picnic basket and ice chest, along with their weapons, and calmly walked out of the prison. Guards noticed the five men but did not realize that Gary or Randy were inmates due to how serenely they left the prison. Ray had his green Ford LTD parked in the prison lot. Once in the vehicle, they sped off to a local hospital where another vehicle, a Lincoln Continental, was waiting for them. They transferred their belongings into the Continental and drove towards Yuma, Arizona. Meanwhile, the captives in the storage closets attempted to break the doors open. They were successful after several attempts, and guards ran to notify the guard tower. The inmates who were locked in the storage closets were questioned by prison officials. They confirmed that there had been murmurings around the prison that Gary Tyson was going to escape to Mexico. Using the intelligence they gathered from the inmates, the Arizona authorities quickly set up roadblocks on all major highways leading towards Mexico. They put on a be on the lookout for a green Ford LTD. They weren't aware that the gang had switched vehicles. It was too late by then, as they had reached Yuma. Upon entering Yuma, the car got a flat. Ricky and Donnie got out to repair the flat, and they continued driving towards Quartzsite, Arizona. They experienced a tire blowout and were left stranded on the highway since they had already used their only spare tire. They had no choice but to pull over and wait for assistance. They were on a desolate part of Highway 95, and travelers were few and far between. The men built a campfire to keep warm. It was after midnight when a pair of headlights appeared in the distance. Ray got up and stood by the trunk of the car and waved at the passing motorist. 24-year-old John Lyons was a United States Marine sergeant traveling with his family to his hometown of Omaha, Nebraska. His 22-year-old wife, Donelda, held her 22-month-old son, Christopher, in her arms. His niece, 15-year-old Teresa Tyson, and her dog sat in the back seat. John pulled over, got out of the car, and approached Ray to assess the damage. The two men cordially greeted each other, and John was put at ease, thinking he was all alone. He walked over to the shredded tire and asked Ray if he had a spare. Ray said, "We used our last spare." John was confused, looked inside the vehicle, and saw no one. Looking back at Ray, he said, "We?" Almost on cue, Gary, Randy, Donnie, and Ricky emerged from the brush. They brandished the shotgun, and John realized his family was at risk. One of the men ordered the women out of the vehicle and into the Lincoln Continental. John tried to get back to his vehicle to retrieve his .38 caliber revolver, but was forced back into the Lincoln Continental. He tried to calm his sobbing wife and niece. He assured them they would be okay. They were likely just going to rob them, and then they could go. He must have known deep down that that was not going to happen, that it wasn't true. They were driven by Gary into the desert, while the Lyons vehicle followed behind. Gary led them far into the desert. He made sure that the Lincoln was parked where it couldn't easily be found. Then he shot up the car to ensure it was undrivable. The sound of the gunshots must have been terrifying for the hostages. The family sat in the back of the Lincoln, watching Gary and Randy discuss something. John cried out, "Please, just leave us with some water. There's some in the trunk of the car. Please." Gary nodded and told Ricky to grab the jug of water. When Ricky returned, he handed the jug of water to his father. Gary took a small sip, dropping the bottle to the ground, letting the water pour out. John's heart sank, and then a hail of bullets assaulted the trapped family. The screams were muffled by the bullets, and when the shooting ceased, all you could hear was young Christopher crying. Christopher survived the initial flurry of bullets because his mother shielded him with her body. Gary walked back to the car and shot the toddler, killing him instantly. John survived but remained unconscious. Danelda had taken much of the assault and was killed instantly. Her body shielded Teresa. Teresa survived but had been hit in the hip and was bleeding profusely. Her dog had been protected and was not injured. She played dead and helplessly listened as her family was murdered beside her. She held her breath until the Tyson gang transferred their belongings from the Lincoln to the Lion's Mazda. The Tyson gang drove off, abandoning the vehicle and victims. John regained consciousness and crawled out of the vehicle, but died a few feet away. Teresa exhaled sharply and crawled out of the car, cradling her dog. She crawled 1,000 feet towards what she thought was the roadside. Instead, she headed towards the opposite way and found shade under a brush. Teresa realized she could go no further, so she took the collar off of her dog and wrapped it around her ankle. She wanted her body to be identified once they were found. She curled up in the fetal position, holding her dog close, and they both passed away in the unforgiving desert. After brutally murdering the Lyons family, the Tyson gang continued their journey towards Quartzsite and stopped in the town of Wendon, Arizona, to purchase some spray paint. The Lyons' Mazda was a bright orange color, which was bound to draw attention towards the rough-looking men. Once people realized the Lyons had gone missing, there would be an alert to look for the bright orange Mazda. They spray-painted the car a silver color. They were now headed to Flagstaff, Arizona, to see if Randy's pen pal, an occasional prison visitor, Kathy Ehrmantraut, could help them find a more suitable vehicle. Kathy really liked Randy and happily agreed to help them find a new vehicle and buy more bullets for their guns. When Kathy was out shopping for vehicles with Donnie, a detective made a connection. He knew Randy Greenewalt and Kathy had a pen pal relationship when he was in prison. He decided to pay a visit to her trailer to see if he would catch Randy there. When the detective knocked on the door, he noticed the trailer was relatively quiet. He didn't see Randy peering out from the curtains, so the detective left and informed his lieutenant that he wanted to set up surveillance on Kathy's trailer. When Donnie and Kathy returned from the lot with a truck, Gary was less than pleased. He wanted a van, but had to make do with what they had. Kathy asked Randy what the man who knocked on the door looked like. After describing him, Kathy said that it was a local detective. Gary wasn't willing to take any chances and ordered his sons to take 2 of the seats out of the Mazda and bolt them down in the truck bed. The gang was now headed towards New Mexico. On August 6, 1978, just 2 days after they left Flagstaff, Arizona, a game warden found the abandoned Lincoln Continental and the gruesome scene that accompanied it. He radioed in his discovery and reported that 3 bodies were found. Teresa's body would not be found until 5 days later, despite only being 1,000 feet away from the crime scene. By the time the bodies of the Lyons were discovered, the gang had already traveled through Arizona. They parked the truck at the Bottomless State Park in Roswell, New Mexico. They were ill-prepared to be camping in the elements as they only had 2 sleeping bags to share. Gary didn't anticipate the need for so many car changes or camping gear. He had hoped that his wife would have come through on her end to supply the plane they needed to get to Mexico. Gary informed his sons and Randy that he was going to try and call his brother Joe to see if he could help them find a plane. If he could, then they would be off to Mexico within a few days. The men were relieved with the news. The campgrounds were uncomfortable and put a strain on their bodies. Later that day, Gary phoned his brother Joe. Joe recognized Gary's voice almost instantly and turned off the recorder that was attached to his phone. Police had tapped the phones of all of the Tyson relatives in the hopes that one of the Tyson men would reach out. Joe seemed to put family loyalty over justice and told his brother he could help him get a crop duster and to meet him in Clovis, New Mexico, around 4 p.m. Gary thanked his brother and returned to the campsite to share the news. Gary told his sons that they would have to return home after the plane was secured, since a crop duster only fit two people. The boys were displeased to hear this news. They would have to either face the consequences of their actions or be on the run forever. Gary didn't care what they did afterwards, but would continue using his sons to further his goal to get to Mexico. Joe immediately contacted the Pinal County Sheriff's Office to inform them of the call. He was afraid of his brother and wanted to ensure he had police protection if he shared the information he had gathered. The sheriff's office agreed to protect Joe and his family. When Joe told them of the meetup place, word spread quickly across law enforcement agencies. A sheriff at Coconino County believed it was a good idea to inform the media of this new development. When Joe and other deputies arrived at the airport, they saw a gaggle of news trucks and reporters waiting to get a quote from them. Gary was extremely angry with his brother when the van pulled up and he saw the swarm of police cars and news vehicles. They turned around and headed towards Colorado. They spent another cold night sleeping in Alamosa, Colorado. Gary was told by Donnie that the truck's transmission was due to give out any day and that they needed to find another vehicle. When the morning of August 9, 1978 came, they continued driving through the state when they happened upon a construction roadblock. They were planning on driving up to Durango, Colorado to get the truck's transmission fixed, but when they stopped behind a van with Texas license plates, they knew they had found exactly what they were looking for.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
She curled up in the fetal position, holding her dog close, and they both passed away in the unforgiving desert. Gary told one of his sons to get out and pretend to check out the construction that was taking place up ahead. When it was reported back that there were only two people in the van, a man and a woman, Gary laid out his plan of attack. The young couple were James and Margene Judge. They had gotten married just 4 days before in Amarillo, Texas. They were honeymooning in Colorado and had plans to see the Dallas Cowboys play the Denver Broncos that following Sunday. Gary had other plans for the newlyweds. He and Randy exited the vehicle and approached the van. Almost in sync, they pulled open the doors of the van and shoved pistols into the sides of James and Margene. The couple was startled and held their hands up quickly. Randy ordered both of them to the back of the van, and Gary began driving. James and Margene begged to be released and promised not to say anything. They could have whatever they wanted. Randy silenced them, and they continued their trek up the windy mountain roads. When they arrived at Chimney Rock, Gary parked the van and told the boys to wait there. He got back inside and drove a few more miles down the road. James again begged them to just leave them there, but they were ordered out of the vehicle. Randy began taking Margene in the opposite direction of her husband, who protested. When Gary pointed the gun towards James's head, he silenced himself. Gary walked James 100 or more feet into a wooded area. He ordered James to his knees and shot him once in the head. Another shot rang out from the opposite side of the wooded area, and both bodies fell to the ground. Gary took James's wedding ring to pawn later. When the men returned to Chimney Rock, they transferred their gear into the van. Donnie devised a plan to still get the truck serviced at a dealership so that it wouldn't be reported as abandoned. Gary approved of this idea, and they headed towards Cortez, Colorado, to drop the truck off. They searched for abandoned houses to sleep in to avoid being found in the van in case the Judge couple was reported missing. The next morning, Gary informed them that they were heading back to Arizona to drive to Mexico. Authorities would not be looking for them in a van. They surely would be searching for them in the Lions' Mazda by now. He had one last chance to get a plane, and that was from his sister Martha's husband, Don England. They arrived in Casa Grande late on August 10, 1978. He phoned his brother-in-law, who said that he could be of no assistance. No planes he had access to could fly to Mexico, and further, it would be impossible to help since every one of their family members was under heavy surveillance. Gary slammed the phone down and kicked the phone booth. He returned to the van and told everyone they were driving to Mexico. He knew some back roads and had friends nearby who could help smuggle them through. When the boys noticed that they were not headed towards the back roads, they asked their father where they were going. He simply said that he wanted to talk to his brother Joe. When he arrived at Joe's home and found it empty, he returned to the van frustrated. Gary was right to assume that law enforcement agencies would not be looking for him in a van. That same evening, an attempted break-in was reported at the Border Patrol Armory in Gila Bend, Arizona. Authorities thought they had their suspect. Gary just couldn't stay away from Casa Grande or armories. Although Gary Tyson was never near the Gila Bend Armory, the Sheriff's Department set up various roadblocks around Casa Grande. When a report came back that the armory break-in was a false report, the roadblocks were withdrawn. Only, no one ever told anyone to actually remove them, so authorities waited patiently for vehicles to pass through, hoping one of them would be Gary Tyson and company. It was August 11, 1978, at 2:30 a.m., when Donnie, who was driving the van, saw the first roadblock. He looked to his father for guidance on what to do. Gary told him to step on the gas and run through the roadblock. Donnie was afraid and told his dad that they weren't going to make it. Gary screamed back, "Floor it, goddammit!" Officers saw the van begin to accelerate and pulled out their weapons. Randy Greenewalt and Gary Tyson leaned out of the vehicle and began shooting their weapons at the officers. An officer radioed ahead to the second roadblock and said the van approaching was Gary Tyson and Randy Greenewalt. Squad car lights were quickly approaching from behind, and Gary yelled at his son to go faster. Donnie was nearing the second roadblock and almost cleared it until he was shot in the head. The shot caused the van to spin out of control, and Donnie's body fell on his brother Ricky. Ray hid behind the back seats of the van. They must have been shocked upon seeing their father climb over them and push Randy aside to get out of the van first. As he ran out of the van, Gary screamed, "Every man for himself!" Gary was a coward. He only used his sons and Randy to get what he wanted. When they were no longer of use to him, I'm sure he would have disposed of them with great ease. They watched as Gary ran out towards the desert. The remaining men followed suit and attempted to hide themselves. A police helicopter spotted the three men hiding in a nearby ditch. They abandoned their weapons and surrendered. Gary was still on the lam, so his reign of terror was not yet concluded. Gary hid himself near a chemical plant in a wash. He had apparently been very angry about his circumstances. He kicked so hard that holes were made in the wash that he was in. He must have been cursing his luck, but he was to die a torturous death. He had nowhere else to go. If he exposed himself, he would be caught, and there was no way he was going back to prison for the rest of his life, or even to be put to death. It is surprising that he chose not to end his own life with the gun that was underneath his body. The medical examiner confirmed that he had been dead about 5 to 10 days before his body was discovered. He was found 11 days later by a chemical plant employee who noticed a foul smell in the air. When he found Gary's sunburned and exposed body, he immediately called the authorities. Reporters were quickly on the scene, and word reached the Tyson family that Gary was dead. Joe was relieved, but others had a difficult time accepting his death. Randy, Ray, and Ricky were charged with several felonies, including murder. The governor of Arizona quickly removed Warden Cardwell from duty for failing to listen to the warnings of Robert Toussaint and for running an inappropriately lax prison. It's unclear to me when Randy Greenewalt gave up the location of the judges' bodies, but they were not discovered until November of 1978. In 1979, the three men were sentenced to death for the four lives that were stolen in August of 1978. For their assistance in aiding and abetting the two felons, Dorothy Tyson was sentenced to a year in prison, Joe Tyson was given 4 years, and Kathy Ehrmantraut was fined and given probation. Warden Cardwell left the Arizona prison system in shame, but found employment at the Ohio Department of Corrections. Ray and Ricky Tyson appealed their life sentences, and on November 3, 1986, their lawyers argued before the Supreme Court that they should not be held responsible for the four murders since they didn't pull the trigger. On April 21, 1987, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor offered the following opinion. Although petitioners neither intended to kill the victims nor inflicted the fatal wounds, the record might support a finding that they had the culpable mental state of reckless indifference to human life. Their death sentences were upheld, but they got a lucky break in 1989. Their death sentences were vacated by the Arizona Supreme Court due to their age at the time of the crimes. They were instead sentenced to life in 1992. On January 23, 1997, Randy Greenewalt uttered his final words. "I have prayed for you many times, and the Lord is using you well. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine." Robert Toussaint won a judgment awarding him $58,000 for the danger he was put in by Warden Cardwell for not listening or believing his statements. He was paroled in 1985, and he is 73 years old today and resides in Tucson, Arizona. The families of the victims murdered by the Tyson Gang and Randy Greenewalt were awarded a civil judgment of $975,000. On September 22, 2017, a movie titled The Last Rampage was released, starring Robert Patrick as Gary Tyson. Raymond and Ricky Tyson are housed together in the Florence State Prison in Florence, Arizona. They are ineligible for parole and will likely take their last breaths behind bars. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review the show on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, you can send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. We would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Southern Fried True Crime Podcast and Kathy. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Research assistance, content editing, and writing assistance for the show was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music.